Welcome to the Weekly Squeak, your weekly geeky squeak with me, Christian Cello. You join me, I'm recording in the afternoon, I'm just having my afternoon coffee here, and my, Cthulhu mug, sort of, Cthulhu man, doesn't really work, Vesuvius Cthulhu, Vesuvius, is that right? Vesuvian, like, Vesuvian, maybe. How is everybody? I took a slight break past week or so, just because I was confirming a lot of interviews and I kind of wanted to wait until I had those interviews confirmed and then go ahead. And now I have a lot of interviews lined up, actually. So it's going to be a packed couple of months now with a lot of interviews with people from all sorts of technical walks of life. This episode, I have Matt Billman from Netlify back on the show. I think he's been on at least once before, talking about the state of Jamstack, what Netlify have been up to, and a whole bunch of other things around kind of the future of content delivery on the web. I do apologize, it is now getting to, I was looking out the window, it's now getting to the period, the season of Berlin gloom, and I'm not in the I have two recording streaming locations, and I'm in home location today, and I don't have lights here, I just have my desk light, which is not great, but it's very gloomy today. In fact, the cat is so comfortable in the gloomy winter, it's nearly falling off of its perch. Anyway, let's get to my links for the week. So there's actually been quite a few interesting things the past few weeks, but I've sort of stripped down to some of the most recent. Here's one on ZDNet from Zoom, launching Zaps on Zoom, building out its ecosystem. I've actually just come from the past 3 days of helping run an online conference. We used Hopin. I'm actually surprised it's taken Zoom this long to kind of do this properly. And the Zaps, the apps on Zoom, the name I really don't like, and I wonder if Zapier will have any problems with. And the Zaps with 1P, I wonder if they're going to have any issues with that. Could be interesting. We shall see. But yeah, they've offered a lot of kind of integration. It's interesting, this really puts Zoom into a bit more of a Microsoft Teams territory and Google Meets territory, where previously they just did video very well, but not much else kind of thing. And now they're adding a lot of other things, and we'll see how well that plays out. They are a company that very much got thrust into the limelight without really being ready for it. So we'll see. And then they have on Zoom, which is the virtual events and content monetization. It's also good for people like me. Zoom has some features I have been looking into. I should look further into these on Zoom features, especially for streaming. I've been using mostly a combination of Restream and Remotely, depending what I'm trying to do. But those two add up to be quite expensive. Zoom does have some features that those two platforms have, but it's then quite expensive and it doesn't give you the quality of video I want, especially for recording. So I'm still sort of figuring out whether maybe it will be worth me switching to Zoom for some of these. I'm not sure. And especially when I share links to those other platforms, they're not known platforms where Zoom is. And that somewhat helps, strangely. And I forgot to mention at the top, this article was by Larry Dignan from ZDNet. Next, one from a couple of weeks back, actually the end of September, but I really loved this article so much, I really wanted to share it with you. This is on The Verge from Chris Harland Dunaway. Hype Man of the Century is a fascinating story about Justin Sun. Now, I have a little bit of a story here, where I was working much more in the crypto space last year and the very beginning of this year, predominantly in the Ethereum space. And Tron, which is what Justin Sun is behind, was strange. Back last year, he was almost like a bit of a joke figure because he was just, well, the company in general was so big on hyping what they were doing. And we were always a little bit unsure about what was really behind it. But they did very well financially. And then he acquired BitTorrent, which is kind of interesting. And this article sort of talks about why he might have done that. His attitude to work, this kind of fusing of American work culture and Chinese work culture and all sorts of things. This actually reminded me a lot of a podcast I recommended, I think last year on the podcast, called The Missing Crypto Queen. Yeah, just to show there's still a lot of these very high profile, I don't necessarily want to say scam artists. The Missing Crypto Queen definitely was. Justin Sun. Maybe just is not necessarily so much of a con, but just trying to build technology for technology's sake kind of thing. Decentralize everything. The article actually covers this quite nicely. It's a fairly long article about, you know, that just because you can decentralize it, should you? Decentralizing technology is quite hard. And the problems the engineers were having with that and things like that, and the cultural differences and things. But then him as a person is also just absolutely fascinating. Just, yeah, the lifestyle he leads and things like that. It's a fascinating article. Again, much like the Missing Crypto Queen, bits of it you're like, is this fiction or fact? It's hard to tell. Coming back down to reality a little bit, this is actually an article from the Berliner Zeitung, one of the Berlin newspapers, but in their English content section, from Jochen Noblach, who really owns Berlin's startups. And this is quite interesting. So unsurprisingly, SoftBank is one of those. And this is almost the criticism here. And it's been a criticism of startups in Germany, but especially Berlin for some time, that German venture capital, local venture capital, is too slow and too conservative and has too little money to invest in Berlin startups. So many end up looking overseas, and is this a good thing? And yeah, so funds in the US, UK, which is at least vaguely European, and Asia invest way more. So Omio, which is a booking platform, used to be called GoEuro, just got in 100 million from investors in Sweden. That's relatively local, Singapore and Silicon Valley. And I think they were mentioning here that most German investors would never even think about investing that kind of money. And they also got 150 million from Tencent. Tencent are kind of almost keeping up in my mind with SoftBank in terms of these very strategic, quiet investments, large investments. And you sort of wonder if they're slowly taking over without, Anyway, and it mentions here that the UK and French investors are actually far better. This is sort of, somewhat expected with German investment. German investment tends to be conservative. And Berlin got over half, probably pretty much just about half, 6.2 billion that went to German startups. Berlin got 3.7, and it only represents 1/5 of the population, which is interesting. So yeah, if you're interested in some kind of more hyper-local investments outside of the well-known areas, and the Silicon LA, as we call it here, then have a read of that. Next kind of strange, tangential, but interesting article on PC Mag from Matthew Humphreys. This is talking, I don't know if you remember a couple of years ago that Microsoft submerged this deep sea data center. Well, they've retrieved it after 2 years, declaring, and this is basically to take advantage of the cooling of the sea for free, because data centers are very hot. And they dropped 12 racks off the coast of Scotland's Orkney Islands, which is quite cold, 864 servers. And I think it was successful. They just wanted to experiment, and they will see what happens next. I don't know if the infrastructure supporting the network coming out of the data center in the sea is sort of outweighs the cost savings, who knows? But that's kind of the point of the article, and I found it interesting to see what they will do in the future. Next is an article from Jay Hoffman on CSS tricks, probably normally something you're used to referring to for CSS advice. This is a really fascinating series of articles, and this is chapter 4, Search on the History of the Web. Actually, I should go back and read some of the past ones. If you are quite new to the internet, you won't remember names like Lycos, Alta Vista, Yahoo even. You just know Google and what has come post-Google, almost as a counter to Google. And this is a really trip down memory lane, especially for me. I think I used to use Lycos a lot. I think that was my main one. Maybe some others, about how we got here. And I think there was the last season of Halt and Catch Fire also covered this kind of this era. It's quite fascinating. You know me, I love computer history. And finally, an article on the Kramer blog. I think this is a person. So Kramer, I don't know. I should actually check what their name is. Let's have a quick look. Still not quite sure. Don't know. Kramer, anyway. Someone who works for Sentry, talking about an honest review of Gatsby. And this resonated a lot with me because I have found that everyone waxes lyrical about Gatsby. And every time I've ever tried it, it just seems so insanely complicated for wanting to generate static documentation or static sites. And I remember the day, I actually used to do a lot of work with Drupal. And the reasons I left it behind was because you were constantly battling against the framework. And that's why I love the purity and simpleness of static site generators. And when I tried Gatsby, I just felt like this is too much like going back to that. I have to know so much and unpick so much to do basic things. And I've always thought, am I alone here? And this is a very nice, honest review of having the same experience from someone probably with much more technical knowledge than me. So I was reassured to know that I wasn't the only one. Okay, that was my links for the week. And now here's my interview with Matt Billman, where we talk about the future of Jamstack, the current state of affairs of Jamstack, Netlify, static site generators. So nice lead-in from the Gatsby article. Enjoy.
So I'm Matt Billman. I'm the CEO and co-founder of Netlify. And Netlify is a platform that web developers use to build and deploy the fastest sites. So we're based around just this whole architectural idea of the Jamstack, this idea of like making the front end presentation layer of a website or a web application its own thing, and decoupling it completely from like the traditional back end layer, right? Like as we've seen, the world sort of evolved towards a point where the backend layer itself is splitting into all these different APIs and services where some might be your own, but a lot of them are other people's services like Stripe or Algolia or the like. And at the same time, we've seen like this incredibly rapid pace of innovation in the front end space around all the different single page frameworks and site static site generators and build tools and so on. That's really made that whole part of the development experience become very much like its own speciality and its own field of real software development, right? So we saw that happening early on and decided, well, if you're going to do that successfully, you'll need a platform that really supports that whole workflow sort of more end to end, from anything from CI/CD to cloud hosting to serverless functions and so on.
And Netlify has been around for a bit of time. In fact, you've been on the show before at least once, maybe even twice, I can't remember. Or maybe someone else I spoke about with Jamstack. It's something that's very familiar to me. So we're not going to go into massive detail of what Netlify is because we've done that before. And I'll link to that previous episode, but more about what's been happening in the past, I guess, at least year. So I'm going to go back ever so slightly because I've selected a few nuggets from what you've been up to the past couple of months that I wanted to talk about. The interesting one, actually, that I think I came across this through something else that surprised me when I saw it, in that the kind of traditional opposite of something like Jamstack and Netlify was always traditional web stack, a database, some kind of interpretive programming language, etc. And as far as I can tell, you've actually started supporting some of those sites, which I found interesting.
I mean, it's a mixture, right? Like, so several years ago, I guess back in 2017, we introduced the concept of Netlify functions, right? Which was really seeing, like, we saw AWS Lambda come out, and then like Google Functions, Azure Functions, and so on, right? And saw this space of this idea of serverless compute that sort of went a level further than containers, right? Like at the point, like we sort of have good old boxes of servers, right? Like then virtual machine servers, and then like Docker containers, where you were still like essentially managing like a Linux distribution and installing packages and doing systems administration and security work and so on, right? But you had more tools to like distribute and scale the containers. Still very complex, right? And then the serverless movement sort of really came to the point where it said, what if the infrastructure providers could really take all of that maintenance away from you, and you really just choose your language runtime essentially, right? And then you just write code and it runs, right? And that fit really well into this world of like front-end web developers focusing on building user experiences and not on building infrastructure systems or the like, right? at the same time, when we saw those come along, we also saw that they came with all their own complexity of management, right? Like now you have a front end and you have a completely different pipeline for deploying serverless functions. You have you have your front end CDN, and then maybe you have an API gateway for your functions, and you have your CI/CD process for your front end app, but now maybe you need a different one for your functions, and you need to get them to talk and so on, right? So we saw that was kind of like that actually made it really hard for people to adopt in practice, right? So we came up with this idea of like, what if you could just have a folder with functions in your Git repository, and it'll get deployed together with your front end, and it's all just serverless. You just write the code and that's it, right? And of course, that as a platform level also like opened up for like writing an Express server and just serving out of that from a serverless function on Netlify, right? And we totally have people building applications in that way, right? We have a very flexible routing layer, so you can easily just route all traffic to a function if you want and build a monolithic app running in a Lambda function on Netlify. It's not what we encourage people to do, because we don't generally think like that it's the best way to build software, right? But it's totally possible. And then as we've gone along and learned more and more and sort of talked to our customer and listened to the user base and everything, right? We're starting to learn more about like, okay, when you work with this Jamstack architecture, let's say you use functions more as we intend them to, where you maybe write microservices or API endpoints and functions and you talk to them from the front end. Like what are the patterns people build with? What are the things that people do? And like one of the things we learned is that of course, unless you just fall back and build like essentially a monolithic application in your function and you just like build HTML and serve it, right? If you're still taking the Jamstack approach, which again, we encourage people to do, we think it's better for the end users, right? Like you pre-build the initial app shell or the initial like content-driven website and you push it to Netlify so it gets global distribution, it gets incredible fast, you get this very quick instant experience, and then you talk to services or functions for anything that after the like the first render needs to be interactive and dynamic and so on, right? Like that solves a lot of use cases, but we started learning that there is also a set of cases where you need some form of like custom programming to happen during that initial request response cycle, right? Those cases are typically things like personalization, right? Like you want to, like you might be able to pre-build almost everything, but you have some parts that needs to be on the fly personalized for the user, right? They could be sometimes they are things like sometimes personalization can be linked to location, for example, right? Like really common example is large retailers, right? Like you go to their website and if they know that you're visiting their website right next to one of their shops, it would make sense that the page you see on the like on the front of the website immediately have that shop instead of sort of having to go look for where's the shop near me, right? That kind of thing, either you have to like really just serve an app shell and then wait and do it client side. In some cases that's fine, but there are also cases where if you can just program, like if you have already pre-built all these shop pages, right, and you can just program the layer that picks like this person is here, we have a shop close by, let's show the version or insert that job into the page when we show it, right? Like that kind of use case starts becoming really like really interesting, right? So that's why we currently announced like another compute layer, right? Like we currently have the serverless functions layer, and then we announced the edge handler layer that runs in the request response cycle directly on the CDN edge nodes, right? Like so really close to the user. And again, like the other part I would say is that like when you talk about the traditional architecture with your database and so on, right? Like again, you can technically like put up an Express server on Netlify with a function and run that, but it's not like we still think that that's like an outdated architecture. What we do see is that people are building real full-fledged applications with Netlify, including ourselves, right? Like app.netlify.com has always been an app running on Netlify, right? And once they start moving more in that direction, they also start needing different compute primitives, right? Like another one we just announced is background functions, right? For like tasks that doesn't fit into a request response cycle. So a bit the opposite of edge handlers, right? Like edge handlers is like there's some tasks that actually really need to run directly as part of the request response cycle. Edge handlers are ideal for those. There's some tasks that can be in a request response cycle, but as API responses. And then there's some things that takes maybe multiple seconds or even minutes to do that you definitively don't want to do in any kind of request response cycle, right? So we launched background workers for that. And we are building, of course, more and more primitives for people to really like feel comfortable building full-fledged applications and have an easy time doing it with the Jamstack approach. What I don't really see happening is like the old-fashioned, you know, I have my server and my database, right? Like that's what's sort of been fragmented, right? Like you start
because I think my question was going down one path. You went down another path, but we're rejoining again. So let's just roll back and so actually on the edge handlers, just to clarify, there's a blog post here from about a week ago at time of recording. And those you write in the same way you add into the functions folder?
Yeah.
Or
There's a separate folder, right? Like just a folder called edge handlers and then a folder for your functions. But the flow is the same, right? You just write them there, you push to get and they're live.
And I think because this has been the direction that Netlify has been going more and more in, which makes a whole lot of sense in handling large scale enterprise needs, which of course makes sense. People like me and other developers on their side projects don't make a company income, so it makes perfect sense. The ability to this sort of edge. Edge processing, edge computing is a somewhat vague term, but it just means that's overused, I think, at the moment. But to be able to add compute where you need it in certain situations, you say.
Absolutely. I mean, you pointed out the enterprise segment, right? And it's very true that edge handlers as a feature, like one of the big reasons we've invested so much in it has been talking to a lot of the large enterprise customers and really understanding their needs, right? But I don't think it's... I think it's also just another primitive for the architecture, where I think that even the community of developers and so on can figure out lots of interesting things to do with it, because it essentially just gives you complete control over that routing layer, right? Like imagine you just want to do a full cloudinary integration where if you append a few query parameters, it gets resized by cloudinary, right? You can write that just as all of that logic you can write just as an edge handler and put in your folder, right? And now you can just like automatically have the edge layer detect query parameters and send them to cloudinary, right? Like imagine you want to you're experimenting with bundling, right? And you want to create different bundles for different devices, right? Now you can run a little edge handler that does the user agent based device detection and chooses to route to the right bundle based on that, right? Mm-hmm. All of those kind of things are things that suddenly becomes possible for like framework authors and template builders or individual developers to experiment with. So I also think like just the fact that the whole routing layer essentially becomes programmable opens up for a lot of interesting sort of out of the box possibilities.
And some of the other use cases you put here are things like A/B testing and localization, yes. which A/B testing from memory you've had for some time, but it's kind of
it's manual. Very like
it's a manual process,
and it's branch based, right? So we have a very powerful like split testing capability where you can say start serving X percent of my site out of this branch. And then we do that, right? What we see people use that for is typically not so much for actual A/B testing or experimentation, but more for their rollout processes, right? We have this big rollout coming. Let's try it with just 10% of the users and see that everything behaves, and then we'll roll it out, right? But again, for fine-grade personalization or A/B testing, right, it becomes a little too heavy of a hammer to have two different branches, right? Like And there it just becomes really interesting.
And the internationalization, I mean, it linked most of the sort of static site generators you support have functionality for that, which was generally just handled by URL redirects and... Yeah. Yeah. Something else, but it enables you to be a bit more subtle with that as well.
Yeah.
And actually turning, and this is kind of where I'm leading towards, you've slowly been turning static site generators and the whole ecosystem almost back to where they were moving away from, but making it more decoupled. And not all in one place, I suppose.
and we do, I mean, again, it's a little bit like when we launch functions, some people would just like dump an Express server in there and route everything there and start serving out a function, right? Like it's totally possible. I think with edge handlers, people will also experiment a lot with actually doing like server-side rendering at the edge and so on, right? Yeah. But I personally don't like, I'm happy to first of all just see what people build and how it works, right? But from a personal, like what do I think is best? I tend to think that again, like keeping the approach where we do the server side rendering at the build time, deployed to the edge, and then like keep edge handlers much more limited in scope to more being about routing decisions and transformations, and not about like running everything there. I think that will be an easier mental model for developers to work with and be productive
with. And so where my original question was going, which I think is a very short answer because I was quickly looking at the page whilst you were talking, and was that you are sort of now supporting, quote unquote, WordPress, Drupal, and Sitecore, which I think I definitely know the first two, but Sitecore as well are these traditional CMSs. But I realize now you're supporting them in headless mode. So that makes a lot of sense. Yeah.
Yeah. And the
back end is still somewhere else.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. That's still very much coming also from those communities, right? Like Drupal community has done a lot around what they call decoupled Drupal. I was at the last conference in New York, I guess, since the recent
one. When Apple invited Bill Gates onto the stage, like, here's the guy who's going to save us. No.
but it's interesting to see, right? Like the same with Sitecore. There's actually a company called Uniform that had some of the early early developers from Sitecore that actually like really built a company around like helping companies use Sitecore as a pure headless solution, right? And the same in the WordPress ecosystem, we're seeing a lot of like a lot of people build with WordPress as just a headless API, and then be able to move much more freely on the front end side. So that's been really interesting to see, like just the dual movement of on the one hand, the traditional CMS is also like Craft CMS has built a strong Jamstack story, Ghost has built a strong Jamstack story, and so on. Right, so seeing all of those going in that direction, Magnolia as well, right? Like lots of movement there. while at the same time also seeing like just the explosion of new pure headless CMSs built with that like mentality from the ground up, like starting with Contentful and Prismic, but then also like Strappy and Sanity and Cosmic.
But it's interesting you say that though. It's interesting you say that because actually in some respects, like something like Contentful and Strappy, they're kind of effectively the same thing. You know, the behind the scenes that what the content editors work with is not too dissimilar from someone.
Yeah. No, and okay. some of the things that are getting really interesting in that space is that some of those tools now, I think, are really starting to actually push the content editor experience beyond what we've seen in traditional CMSs, right? Like Sanity's studio is really interesting. Like the work they just launched with like real time, like diffing of content, like as you're editing, you can see what others are doing. Like it's full, like, full real-time editing of structured content in collaborative mode and so on, a bit like what you get from Google Docs in unstructured content, but for structured content, right? Like,
I hadn't heard of that.
That's really like impressive and interesting, right? And some of the things you see from Stackbit, for example, that like if you go to jamstack.new and just start a project from there, you can immediately get a site with, for example, like a Sanity as a backend and Next as a site generator, a GitHub repository and a whole build process, but with Sanity Studio in front, so you get like a live editor on the page where you can like just like, you know, click an element, edit it with live preview. And when you hit save, they're smart enough to know that, oh, this is like a Sanity content element, we'll send this save back to Sanity and it'll trigger rebuild and everything, right? Like seeing all of that come together is really interesting, right? There's still a lot of innovation happening in this space also for the content editors.
Yeah. I would like to come to JamstackCon and some of that ecosystem in a minute.
Yeah.
I just have one more question sort of specifically around Netlify itself, which was the build plugin, which has been around for a little bit longer, but now it has been around for a little while, and you made a few announcements at JamstackConf. Just, because it's one of those sorts of things, when I looked at it, I thought, this is really useful, and then I must admit, personally, I struggled to think, where would I do this versus like a GitHub action or a CI pipeline and that kind of thing. So what's some of the plugins that people have created, and how do they fit into people's workflows?
Yeah, I mean, build plugins has been a big success for us, with like double-digit percentage of all builds now using plugins, right? Like, and we're seeing a lot of different categories. Of course, there's like sort of the one interesting part is the framework-specific ones, like the Gatsby plugin, and there's like a Next plugin coming. There's like different ones of those where by installing that plugin, we can customize the build to that site generator, right? Say, like, just automatically be sure to cache the right directories between builds and so on, integrate the right things, right? Like, so that's like one set that are really interesting. Then there's a whole set around different forms of like of testing, essentially, right? Like the Lighthouse plugin has been really popular, right? Like, and we've especially seen the UI installs being really popular, right? Like the fact that you can just go in and click a button and say, add Lighthouse, and now you get Lighthouse testing, right? The same with accessibility testing and plugins.
Okay. Oh,
like,
really? Oh, yeah, okay, cool.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. The same with plugins like the Sentry plugin, where there you do have to like at least put in a few environment variables, right? But outside of that, you just like put in the plugin and now it'll start sending, after the build, your source maps to Sentry. Plus the deploy notification, so when you start getting an error in your JavaScript detected in users' browsers, Sentry will be able to correlate it to a source map and show you which deploy introduced that error, right? Like, and all of that is basically just like UI installable, right? The Algolia plugin is really exciting as well, right? Like where you can essentially just like set up everything you need for search and indexing just by installing a plugin.
So would the division, I guess, be somewhat say you have your GitHub workflow that's triggering Netlify builds, anything yeah. kind of relevant to a pre-build, probably do there and in the old traditional way. And anything for content that is sort of live and served and people are using is where Netlify build plugins come in.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of it is also just down to convenience, right? Like, if you can get a functionality just by clicking a button, then do it. Like, you just saved yourself a lot of time as a developer, right? Like,
sure.
would be my most basic argument.
All right, so let's come to Jamstack Conf. That was also a week ago. Pretty much everything was a week ago that we're talking about. You've already mentioned a few of the things that excited you, but was there, I mean, obviously a lot of the talks were pre-chosen and pre-prepared, so you kind of knew what was coming, but were yeah, there any kind yeah. of themes or discussions that made you think this is a really exciting space to be, or things that took you by surprise that people showed?
I mean, I always get super excited by all the lightning launches, just seeing like what other people are building in the space and bringing to customers. I loved seeing all the little jam snacks from the different framework authors. We got all the different frameworks to sort of record a little 2 minute like video, and just seeing again like the whole vibrancy in that whole ecosystem, from like larger players like Next or Gatsby to the innovation happening around like 11T or even Chris Biscotti's Toast, which is still a very like new project, but just one that I think is really interesting, like taking like at JavaScript based environment, but making the actual tool that builds it based on Rust to get like all the capabilities and performance there, while still having developers work in a JavaScript based setting. I think there's a lot of interesting opportunities in going that direction. It's still early, right? Yeah, so all of those things are always things that gets me really excited. Of course, I had a fun talk with Matt from WordPress as well. and of course, it's just like an exciting thing that Jamstack has gained this momentum where people like that feel like they need to address it, right? Like that's been really positive to see. And then of course we are always really excited to see what like the interactions and the feedback on the things we are building and that we have on our roadmap. And also in seeing like customers like Teespring or ACLU and so on build really exciting projects and tell real world stories around this being used in the world.
And do you still feel like this, the Jamstack space, and you've already mentioned a couple of interesting projects that you could consider at least partial competitors to what you do, but it still seems that the space is relatively okay with that, and there's still enough kind of interest for everybody.
I mean, competition is also healthy, right? Like any really vibrant, healthy space will have competition, right? Like and that sure goes for this space as well, right? We have plenty of different types of competitors out there. But in a certain way, I would be a lot more worried if that wasn't the case, right? Like,
yes, true.
I think
it's just
a sight that the category is really advancing, and both new small players are looking in our direction, and the traditional big cloud players are starting to take it like very seriously, right? Like, which I think it's just a sign that this is a very real phenomenon, and that it's that it's going to play a really important part in the future of the web.
You've given me a perfect in to ask. So what's the plan for the next 6 months?
Well, we'll keep trying to sort of push the boundaries for what you can do with this architecture from like an architecture and platform specific standpoint, right? Like we've always been fairly conscious of not ourselves like championing like a very specific framework, right? Like we feel like there's a lot of different paths there, and there's a lot of innovation there. We want to encourage all of that innovation, and we want to give businesses a place where they can run all their Jamstack projects across all these different tools and frameworks. But where we're really like thinking is always like, how can we give these framework authors and the developers new primitives to build on and to solve real problems with, right? So things like edge handlers, background function, we will be introducing scheduled tasks as well for like both scheduled functions like cron jobs and so on, or scheduled builds as well, right?
I personally need that.
yeah. And we have some other big pieces of primitives on the roadmap that it's still a little early to talk about, but that I'm also very excited about taking to market.
That would be super cool. Currently, I'm playing with... I have a scheduled job to aggregate posts from various places onto my Netlify hosted website.
Nice.
And at the moment, I'm just running it locally. And I was thinking, I guess I'll put it on Heroku or something like that. But,
I'll make sure we get you an early a beta invite when we're ready to add some tests for that.
I need to do a few things first. It's using some heavily customized Ruby gems at the moment that I don't think would even run anywhere at the moment. So I need to fix those first.
So we are actually, I should say, we're just about to introduce Ruby as a runtime for our... Netlify functions as well. So we might be able to even run them in a background
it's
function.
It's just I'm still using Jekyll. I'm still using Jekyll and really pushed it to the limits, but I just can't be bothered moving it. But it is really starting to creak at the seams with what I'm doing to that site. I just don't have I barely have the time to keep it up to date, let alone migrate it. So, but it's actually been kind of fun. I need to document what I've been doing. I have a whole bunch of weird stuff going on now with Zapier and Git and RSS feeds. RSS feeds are still very powerful.
Yeah, they are.
Things like
they
that.
Are.
So, yeah.
Never underestimate the power of an RSS feed.
No. I when I can't find one on a website, I'm always very disappointed because then I can't look
it. Yeah.
Maybe that's why they do it. But anyway, so. For anyone who missed Jamstack, there's jamstackconf.com. I'd also suggest as a good introductory there's a post on your blog about the winners of the Jammies as well. The prize was a pair of jammy pants. I'm glad to the connection was made there. Yes. That seemed too obvious to me. Excellent. That's pajamas, in case anyone is wondering what on earth we're talking about. There's a good list of some interesting projects there. Actually, I'm particularly interested in looking at lunch money. Cool. We used to use YNAB, you need a budget, years ago, and then moved away to something else. But it's always nice to see some other options in that space. So, yeah, have a look at that post as well for some good roundups. But... once again, thanks for coming and keep up the good work.
Thank you so much. Always a pleasure.
That was my interview with Matt Billman from Netlify. Hope you enjoyed that. Okay, updates. I've actually published a lot of the D&D live streams I've been participating in as a player and also as a DM on my website and Quick Test Dummies Twitch channel. I recently finished up Kubeflow and Code Lobster on the Dexpose live feed. It's like that needs to be updated there on the website. I have been continuing with the Solo Adventurer and Alone Against the Flames. I'll be doing another part of that tomorrow. And what else? Oh, yes, we did a Hacktoberfest doc special with me, Lorna Jane, and Deborah Starfalls. And have a look at that. Watching us live, just blundering around, trying to figure things out whilst talking to a camera. And episode 2, again, it's not on the website yet, but you can find it on the anchor page here. Episode 2 of Stories About People is live. Episode 2 of Board Game Jerk is also live, which you can also find at boardgamejerk.com. So lots of new things live there. I'm still doing a lot of overhauling behind the scenes on my website. It's coming together slowly, getting there. What else? I'll have a few new blog posts soon, actually.
There's a new post, a couple of new posts from me on the Humanitech blog. And I'm actually doing some talks. I'm finally getting my stuff in gear to do some online conferences, presenting at online conferences in December. So there's a couple coming up there for me. But keep an eye on my events page for that. Thank you very much for joining me, whether you joined on video or on audio. If you enjoy what you hear or see, please subscribe to the podcast. Please subscribe to the YouTube channel. You can find out more about me at christianchiller.com. Please rate, review, share if you like this. I am very, very nearly done overhauling my newsletters. So my weekly Squeak newsletter that accompanies this podcast and video will be having an overhaul soon. And I'll also be adding some automated topic newsletters from other content that sometimes I come across. And that'll be coming very, very soon. I'm migrating them back to MailChimp, actually, and getting the templates in process and stuff like that. So watch out for that. But once again, I'll see you next week. And thank you for joining me.